Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Karen knew she wanted to be a social worker from a young age and has spent a career focusing on children and adolescents. Now as Director of Operations Clinical Transformation at Oxygen, Karen supports and enables the integration and efficiency of clinical services, programs and projects to deliver successful outcomes in both an operational and strategic capacity. In this episode, Karen touches on life as a social worker and why it's important to employ self-resilience and self-care whilst taking care of other people in times of need. We also speak about the challenges facing the sector right now, where the current areas of improvement lie, and why collaboration is so important.
Welcome back to another episode of Pebble in the Pond. I'm your host, Talitha Natt, and this afternoon I am sat with Dr. Karen Hart at the Child and Adolescents Mental Health Conference on the Gold Coast. Dr. Karen Hart is a qualified social worker, researcher and senior executive leader of operations and service delivery, who has spent almost 30 years engaging and working with children, young people and their families. Karen is a strong advocate for the safety, education, health and justice needs of children and young people. How are you doing, Karen? It's lovely to have you here.
Really good, Talitha. Thank you.
Also, before we get into any type of questions, the accent. Where's that from?
It's from Northern Ireland originally.
Northern Ireland.
But I've been here for nearly 25 years in beautiful Australia.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So I was going to say Scottish. I was like, wait, no, hang on. That's probably wrong. So I'm glad I can, close, but not quite. Karen, just reading your bio when I was getting some notes ready for our chat this afternoon, I thought to myself, gosh, you really have done or worn many hats in your career. So did the social working start? I mean, did that come first and
yes.
Then you went into researching?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then you went into more executive roles where you are now?
Yes,
great.
Absolutely. So it's been quite a journey, really. I started out as a child protection social worker in the UK and did that for a couple of years and then moved into justice work, so court advocacy work with young people and keeping young people out of prison, essentially.
Wow.
I've worked for government and not-for-profits across my whole career, but always focused on children and young people. So that is definitely a very clear sort of vein that threaded throughout my last 30 years. And then I came to Australia and one of my first jobs actually was to coordinate the remand centre at Parkville Juvenile Justice Centre, as it was then, which was really interesting because I'd spent all of my life keeping kids and young people out of prison to then go behind the prison wall and see what life experience was actually like for those young people who were incarcerated. And that really opened my eyes and reinforced to me why I was doing all the previous work that I was doing in terms of keeping those young people out. And the importance of keeping young people out of any sort of detention or enforced sort of environments. And as you can imagine, obviously, you know, many of these young people were presenting with enormous vulnerability, mental health issues, family violence. And there was a huge overrepresentation, as there still is today, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, Asian young people, and now more recently, African young people. And then moving on a couple of years, I went to work for the Sacred Heart Mission in St Kilda, where I worked with homeless street working women for a couple of years, and then got into co-located youth service provision. So constructing spaces and facilities and environments where young people would feel attracted to come and have a range of their needs met simultaneously by a group of not-for-profits and services collaborating under one roof as a one-stop shop. Did that for many years. I was the CEO of the Youth Junction in West Melbourne, and then went on to do something very different after 15 years of doing that, and headed up the youth and community degrees at Victoria University. So across 6 degrees, around things that I had learned across my career through, you know, experience and being able to, I guess, pass on to up and coming social workers, youth workers, some of the anecdotes, some of the strategies and skills that I had employed and honed over the years to work effectively with vulnerable young people and children.
Wow. Gosh. I find the social working area so fascinating in the sense that you really are on the front line of helping people that need the most help that they could possibly get. And I would imagine it's not perhaps for the faint-hearted, given what type of scenarios you might be dealing with. What advice would you give to someone who wants to work in social work, whether it's with youth or other areas of vulnerable population or populations rather? What's the one piece of advice you would say to them before they embark upon their career?
You know, that's a great question, and thanks for asking that, because I guess when you've been in this type of career, you do reflect on how things are impacting you, how people's narratives and experience has impacted you, and what you're being exposed to every day, listening to people's narratives and looking at different graphics and hearing certain anecdotes. And you often question how resilient you are yourself to be able to manage other people's pain and trauma that they've gone through. And, you know, caring does come at a personal cost. It's a transaction. So in order to be authentic and genuinely empathic with children and young people, which you have to be in the moment, it takes something from you. Mm. And whilst you're giving back, you know, you do lose, not necessarily lose a little something of yourself, but you're giving some of your inner personal resource to mm-hmm. meet that issue or need in a genuine way. And so you have to self-care. You have to have a balanced life, you know, not to forget that your life isn't only about investing your time and caring for other people at the expense of not caring, investing people that are close to you, mm-hmm. your only, mm-hmm. you know, your own family, your partner, your friends, whatever. So making time for your personal activities and relationships is really key. Doing the things that you love, traveling, exercise, and spending time with the people that you love. And mm-hmm. I know they sound like fairly basic things, but they're fundamental.
Yeah.
They sound basic because they are fundamental to everybody. And in fact, part of the work with children, adolescents, and families is about encouraging them to be able to create time for doing things as well. So resilience is important, but it's a peculiar, often overused word and means a very individual thing to each person, because we've all got different levels of tolerance, vulnerability, susceptibility to, you know, read things, interpret things in certain ways. And so really it's about self-reflection, mm. you know, and finding what your strengths are and you know, making time for yourself.
So would you say that one of your strengths would be working with young children and adolescents? I mean, is that the area in which you've spent the majority of your time?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if I've gone off to do other things, I've always gravitated back to that purpose. And I feel that much of my life, really, because I've known that I wanted to be a social worker since 16.
Really? Wow.
That is a frightening without showing my age. So to, you know, have that drive across so many years, that is absolutely the one sustained thing with that mm-hmm. need to, and also an understanding that I could lend or impart my skill to look after children and young people, you know, who families or carers couldn't, or for whatever reason, didn't want to. after the children.
Got an observation of mine that I'm just thinking of as you speak, and that is that a lot of social workers or peer workers that I've come into contact with have often come from quite challenging experiences of their own, whether they're, you know, challenging experiences when they were young or their young adult life. Would you agree that a lot of social workers work in that space because they've had a little bit of a turbulent experience in life thus far and they want to help others based on their own?
It's a very good question, and it's a theory.
Mm.
And I know that when I was on my social work degree in my early 20s, after the first year, 50% of students dropped away from the course,
right,
as we were due to do our first practical placement. And to me, that's no coincidence that, mm-hmm, as you say, you know, in your 20s, when you're going into social work, think that because you've got a lived experience of trauma or neglect or abuse or whatever it is, family violence or an alcoholic parent or, you know, parents who've been to prison, that you've got something to give back.
Mm.
But when I spoke earlier on about reflecting before you embark and checking in with yourself as you do your work, there can be incredible challenges around over-identification. You know, if you're not balanced and level-headed and grounded, you know, the exchange and the transaction between you and somebody else who's experienced trauma, neglect and abuse can be very warped in some ways. So you really have to ensure that you cleared your own deck before, or at least, you know, find some way to reconcile it before you work with other vulnerable young people, I think.
Yeah, that's great advice. From your perspective, where do you see there are areas for improvement when it comes to the current services available for child and adolescents' mental health?
I mean, this is another big question, and certainly something that Origin Health in Melbourne is focusing very clearly on. We're going through a period of transition and transformation as we move to create one model of care across our entire service system. So from early intervention to primary to secondary, and then further into enhanced tertiary acute and crisis care. And because we recognize that the system is currently fragmented, it's no surprise that when a young person or their carer or family member wonders where the best place for their child is to receive support, mental health support, where do they start looking? Because they're presented with this kind of unnavigable sort of maze of organizations doing brilliant things, some with short-term funding, many in the not-for-profit sector, many based in metropolitan cities, but not in regional and rural areas. And so the internet helps and word of mouth helps and brands help. So if you think about the Headspace brand, it's a very powerful magnet for people to understand that they can go to their local centre. An Origin actually auspiced 5 of these centres in the Northwest. And that's very effective because people automatically know that that's a helping service for young people. And there's, because it's so respected, it's got, I guess, a reduced stigma for young people to be able to front up and get help. But it nonetheless remains that, you know, it is difficult to navigate the system. And so, you know, I think promoting, having conferences like the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Conference and other trauma conferences that bring, and, you know, all range of disciplines together that are connected to mental health, to be able to network, to get a deeper understanding of who is actually part of that service system is really valuable. Mm. And in fact, it would be one of my key messages would be that if you are a practitioner and you are working with children and young people, make it your business to understand your local service system and who does what. And furthermore, you know, try and connect with what I call critical friends within those organizations who can add value to the work that you're doing.
Yeah. You know, I hear this a lot across our mental health conferences, and it seems to me that what you're saying about the system being like a maze and there's so many different smaller or bigger larger, whatever, institutions, services, bodies within this maze, and you're all going and seeking the same funding to support what it is that you do in the sector, but rather than working together, everyone's working against each other to get this funding, to get this project, whatever it is, off the ground. And it, when you think about it, it really makes no sense that there isn't an alliance or a partnership whereby this maze can be less of a maze and more of a hub. Yeah. And that's an ideal world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's another good point. And I think the tide is starting to turn in that respect. I mean, I haven't seen the sector for too many years, maybe. And being aware of the shifts that are happening all the time. Traditionally, not-for-profits would have been very much in competition with each other. But I think the government has got a much better understanding of the amplified impact that services and not-for-profit organizations collaborating together can have. That no one discipline, no one organization can respond effectively to the needs of adolescents and children. And so to work collectively in the same direction is absolutely the way to go. And I think we're seeing more of that. I know that certainly the organizations that I've been part of for the last 15 years or so are really clear of their need to collaborate, partner. The trick is then getting government funding or funding from another source, philanthropic source or whatever, to be able to sustain that partnership.
Yeah.
So investment is needed right across the board. And I don't think there's been ever a more important time in our history than there is now in terms of youth mental health. And we see that in the data. And so, we really need to be advocating very strongly for those collaborations.
Absolutely. Aside from the challenges we've already touched on earlier, what do you feel is going to be the pressing area of focus for this year, for next year, when it comes to child and adolescents' mental health?
Thank you. I think post-COVID, we're learning a lot. We're having the breathing space to reflect on the impact that that had on the psychological stress that that created, not just for children and adolescents, although, you know, they basically had at least 2 years of their critical development phase robbed from them because of that experience. And if people didn't undergo psychological distress, that would have been pretty peculiar during that time. So it taught us a lot, and it taught the whole community equally, and in fact, the globe equally. Nobody was untouched by that. And so it's an opportunity for learning about how people are impacted as a collective when a crisis like that happens, and to try and be able to extrapolate that thinking to smaller crises that are constantly happening in our community. So you think Australian bushfires and floods, and then more locally, you know, shootings and violence. And if you taper that down then into the family unit, what's going on there? So I think it gave us an opportunity to expose the real harms in our society for children and young people. And those are important learnings. Doing some response.
Can we talk about your research experience? What are you working on at the moment? Or let's talk about, if you're not working on something currently, what have you been working on recently?
Very good question. So when I was with Victoria University for a couple of years, along with my teaching, a good part of that was research as well. And I was looking at the experience of Pacifica young people in the education system, and the fallout of Pacifica young people and the need for alternative education, and what an alternative education framework would look like to create cultural safety, to get them in the door in the first place, so to engage them, and then to provide education that's based on their interests and their kind of career and job prospects, as well as attending to their academic needs, so ensuring that they've got literacy and numeracy whilst doing something practical or vocational. So that's kind of one area of my research. And another one was looking at the impact of the youth workers and teachers who work with vulnerable groups of young people, many who are justice involved, and the vicarious or secondary trauma that they experience as a result of working, interacting, being involved in critical incidents, calming young people down with the classroom environment. And that sort of buys into what you were saying earlier around people going into the job because they've got a passion and compassion that's derived from some of their historical or childhood experiences themselves. And what came out in the research was factors around, you know, burnout of staff and recognizing and acknowledging when staff were feeling really distressed by the work that they were doing. And what type of support and supervision structures do you need to have in place within the workplace to protect and retain those fantastic staff that you've spent years as a workplace investing in and professionally developing, so that when there is an incident, they aren't always the one who takes sick times off sick. So I guess it all sort of fits in with work that I've been doing over all these years and seeing what the deficits are in certain workplaces, the challenges for employers to look after staff and make sure that they're caring for themselves and the workplace is caring for them.
It's hugely important, isn't it?
It really is. in any industry.
Yeah. It's a whole different topic, isn't it, really? Now, if you could change anything within the mental health sector, what would it be?
Wow, funding. Would be the obvious one.
Yes.
Sustained funding. And definitely to go back to what you were saying earlier, I mean, collaboration, partnerships, creating a more cohesive service system and kind of changing the institution of the old institutionalized views of the mental health system.
Yeah.
That there are very few disciplines who don't belong in the helping process, health system. And many families deal with the mental health of their children. The isolation and never have any professional involved. And they do an all right job. You know, there are many adults who have said, if it wasn't for that significant person, you know, my coach or my teacher or my worker or whatever, I never would have got through that. But because they do something, you know, I look back and I think, yeah, they were the person that I turned. So it doesn't, you don't necessarily need to have somebody connected to a system to help. It doesn't have to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And that's not to demean what those professions do, but having just a significant person to help anchor you and ground you really is what all young people.
It's great advice. You've been a pleasure to speak with this afternoon, Karen. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.